By the time we get to John chapter 21 in the Gospel of John, we still see the faith of the disciples in very much a developmental phase. All right? Jesus has not been taken back into heaven just yet. We don't get to that till we get to the ascension in Acts chapter 1. But at this point in time in the Gospel of John, they're still kind of between two worlds. They've experienced the resurrection, but it seems like they still kind of don't know what to do. The gospel, this particular gospel, has been encouraging the audience to have faith. In fact, we read that at the end of chapter 20. John wants that for people. That's why he wrote all of this down. But now he reveals the movement toward an entirely new life for the apostles themselves. Again, they've experienced the resurrection, but we still see them in this sort of limbo state. They're not quite sure what to do. So what I'd like to look at John chapter 21, and I'm just going to kind of extrapolate some ideas out. Okay, I'm just going to kind of adapt what's happening here, not necessarily look at the each individual verse, and sort of exegete the text, give you all the details. I'm going to give you what I think are some principles, looking at this from the standpoint of what I think is happening in the lives of the apostles. And I'm going to do it by asking three questions. The first question is, what do I do when the Easter glow wears off? And I'm calling it the Easter glow. It's because it's a lot of what happens in our religious world. People celebrate the Easter event, and in most churches, or at least especially in churches that celebrate Easter, you have a much larger audience. Within a week or two, they're not there. Okay, and I kind of call that the Easter glow. It's something that everybody gets. Maybe they just feel like they need to be there on that day. It's a very special day. It's springtime. It's nice. You're getting out. There's all kinds of factors involved. But the fact is, we all have these kind of mountaintop experiences. I saw this happen numerous times when I went to camp and worked at Camp Manitoni. And the kids are there for a whole week. And it's a great experience. I'm not trying to denigrate the experience. But they get there and they're involved with having devotionals every day. They're talking to their friends who are also Christians. They're encouraging each other. They're singing songs. They get this buildup of a great feeling of what it means to really be in a Christian environment. And then they have to go home, where it's not quite all of that. And, you kind of lose a little bit of the mountaintop experience once you go back down into the valley. And that's kind of what happened. I think that's what's happening here. Okay? The disciples hesitate. They don't know what to do. I've seen several. One was a movie, one was a recent TV program. Some of you may remember many, many years ago, a Robert Redford movie called The Candidate. And there was a recent TV show that was kind of very similar. Both of these people were running for office, and they had never been politicians before. They kind of felt like they had great ideas. They both felt like that, they wanted to replace the corrupt people that were in there. And they both won their elections. One was a very recent TV show, and it was very interesting because once they won the election, once they got through all the experience of running and competing and so forth, and then all of a sudden they learned that they won, both of them, one of them asked his campaign manager, the other one asked his girlfriend, they looked at each other, both had kind of smiles on their face, but they were like, now what do I do? It's like, congratulations, you're a politician. All right, well now what? And I think we have the apostles doing a little bit of the same thing here. They're sort of in that no-go uncertainty zone. What do I do next? And I think that's very true of a lot of us, isn't it? When we grasp the impact of the resurrection, well, we still have to ask ourselves, well, what's going to happen next? Well, what do the disciples do here? They go back to their old jobs. They go fishing. They probably don't know what to do. Jesus maybe hasn't told them everything yet, but there's probably a lot of other mixed emotions going on inside of them. What do? I don't know how to go about this. It's kind of a scene reminiscent of their first recruitment in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, where they get this humongous catch of fish. And maybe it's important because it draws them back to that time. It draws them back to the time that Jesus first called them and said, I'm going to make you fishers of men. Because they spent all this time out on the water fishing, not having any luck. All of a sudden, Jesus comes along and says, well, cast your nets over here. And then they realize something miraculous has happened here. And maybe it's going to signal a change in their lives. John, in verse 7 we find, is the one who recognizes Jesus. And they rush onto the shore, and there's Jesus. And he's cooking some fish and some bread. And he says, well, bring some more of the fish that you got. It's very interesting because none of them say anything. They all know it's Jesus, but they don't say anything. You can tell there's a lot of discomfort. You've been in situations where a silence spoke volumes. That's what's happening here. They're like, okay, who's going to be the first one to break the silence here? Nobody says anything. Now, there may have been some conversation at some point, but maybe they're avoiding any discussion about what he wants from them. Maybe they kind of know there's something going on here that they just don't want to admit. I really don't know. But, you know, a lot of times when we don't know what to do with our newfound faith, we kind of go back to our old ways too easily. And that's one of the mistakes. It's very easy to make. We've all been there. We've all done that kind of thing. We go back to our old life. Well, what's happening here? They have breakfast. That's what's happening. They had breakfast. Jesus is the one who's serving the breakfast here as well. That's kind of an interesting look at it. Jesus is the host and the cook and seems to be the one serving the meal. So again, maybe there's a certain amount of discomfort in the disciples here. We don't hear any of the conversation, but it seems to me having breakfast is a rather mundane setting for trying to get them prepared for the task of changing the whole world, which is essentially what the gospel does once they get their job straight. They're just having breakfast. Maybe they're talking. Or maybe we find out that profound things happen in rather ordinary settings. And maybe we shouldn't underestimate what happens to us in our ordinary settings, that God can do great things with us. But we kind of have to get what he wants us to do, don't we? And that's where the apostles, they're still struggling a little bit. So we move on to what I consider to be another question that kind of fits here. And that is, how do I go on after so many mistakes? And we see that in verses 15 and following when Jesus has this discussion with the apostle Peter. You know, after we look at ourselves and find out just who or what we really are, then we go on. How can we go on here? How can we still serve? We had a little discussion about this Wednesday night and talking about, you know, God says basically we're evil people. We're sinners. Well, what do I do with that? How do I go? How can I serve God when I know I'm a sinner too? The conversation that Peter has with Jesus after breakfast, I think, gives us some indication of, yeah, you can go on. Now, let's remember Peter's denial, in one sense, it really wasn't any worse than what all the others had done. Well, maybe it was a little bit, because he verbalized what they had already done. They had all run away, and basically they had sort of disowned him without actually saying they disowned him. Peter's the one who gets confronted with it and said, you know this guy, don't you? He says, no, I don't know him. Three times it happens. And I think it's in Luke where apparently after the third time, Jesus turns and he catches Peter's glaze. And you can just imagine how Peter felt when this Jesus that he had said, I'll never leave you. The others all may fall away, but I'll never leave you. Suddenly he denied him and Jesus looked at him. Well, I would have felt like I'd been looked straight through, which I'm sure is how Peter felt. You know, Peter was one who constantly made rash commitments and failed miserably. Well, what do we do with that? How do we overcome that? In all honesty, you know, I think Peter was dealing with some things that he hadn't dealt with before. I read a number of years ago a guy by the name of General, I don't know his first name, Boykin, I think is his name. He was the first commander of this elite unit of soldiers called the Delta Force. And they would often do these operations that were very, very dangerous, very high. They had probably the highest skilled soldiers they could find were in this Delta Force. And the general was writing about his experiences, and on the field, it was kind of easy for him in a way to know what to do with enemies. He could either capture them or kill them. That's what a soldier does. And he can develop plans to do that. Once he got off the field and once he had to deal with his political rivals, he had a little different battle on his hand because he couldn't just go kill them. You know, you may want to, but, you know, it's still at least a felony, you know, to do that kind of thing, to kill people. But he had to really struggle with, all right, how do I fight this battle? Peter was ready to fight in the garden, but then when it came down to fighting a different way, he didn't know what to do. Anyway, this was Peter's problem early on, but it's not till we get to 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 through 5. We see a much more mature Peter and being willingly serving as an elder. But this experience, I think, that Peter has sort of begs the question for us. What holds us back? Our guilt? Uncertainty? Feelings of inadequacy? Perhaps. Maybe we just don't want to. Many of God's servants in the past felt inadequate, frustrated, maybe even sometimes by God a little betrayed. You know, Jeremiah felt somewhat betrayed by God, but and yet he kept saying, I got this fire inside and I can't stop. I can't stop talking about God. And we studied Ezekiel on Wednesday night. Good grief. You know, the way Ezekiel was treated by God is like, why would anybody want to do that? We know Moses was a little unwilling at first, wasn't he? This guy, 80 years old, and he says, I want you to go and I want you to lead my people out of Egypt. He's like, me? Jesus repeats a number of questions here to Peter, and whatever Peter's motivation is, or lack of motivation, I certainly think there's some guilt here for Peter. It seems to me Jesus' continued questions are designed to get Peter to confirm his commitment out loud. And maybe to be able to overcome whatever feelings of inadequacy, of guilt, or whatever it is that Peter is struggling with here, Jesus is trying to reinstate him. He's trying to give him a little sense of, okay, everything's going to be okay if you just feed my sheep, feed my lambs and feed my sheep. That's all I want you to do. And he's got to forget the past, and he's got to move on to what lies ahead. You know, Paul tells the Philippians that's what they have to do. And it's not always easy to just forget the past because the past keeps haunting us. You know, these ghosts, these specters of things we've done or things that we feel or whatever feelings we have, they tend to haunt us and keep us back. Jesus reinstates Peter here. What can we do when we feel all these things? It's really a matter of allowing Jesus to make us adequate, to take away our guilt. I mean, we know the answers. But we kind of have to allow Jesus to do that. We have to have enough faith that if he says we're the ones, we're the ones. And that should be hopefully good enough. Third question that I think comes up here as this is very insightful, I think, in terms of what Peter and John do here. I ask the question, why concern ourselves with God's will for other servants? Because that's kind of what we have here as well. In Romans 14 and verse 4, Paul makes the following statement. He says, who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make him stand. Peter's been talking to Jesus. Jesus tells him such and such, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, just follow me. And then Peter's walking along with Jesus, and he must glance around, and I don't know how far back John is, but John's back there, and he says, well, what about him? You know, it's almost like Jesus said, well, what about him? So what? You know, if I say he's going to stick around till I come back, what's that to you? You know, why is it we think we have to be concerned about everybody else's service to God? And now, I realize that we have a legitimate desire and concern to help people, okay? But that legitimate desire and concern can deteriorate into being nosy and a busybody and trying to make sure they do what they're supposed to do. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like what I talked about last week, the Thomas generation gap. I'll be a disciple if he will. And Jesus says to Peter, no, Now, look, if I have a certain will for him, and it's different from my will for you, what's that to you? That really isn't your concern, Peter. Okay? So Jesus does have to address something that Peter is doing, and I think maybe it's just another form of Peter hesitating a little bit. Maybe this is kind of even a mild rebuke to what Jesus had said earlier in the Gospel of Matthew. Take the plank out of your own eye before you can see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Okay? And so Peter's sort of still hanging on to some things here. And Jesus has to confront that. What God has in mind for other disciples, it's not necessarily our concern. Now, if you know that somebody, a friend of yours, is falling into some trap and some serious sin, that's another matter. Maybe that is a concern we have to have for them, but we have to do it in the right way. We have to be able to love that person like Jesus loved them, okay? There's a little sidelight here that I think is also one of the more interesting features of this. It's almost like a little sidebar to the whole article, a little separate thing. But it's this case of the rumor that starts spreading around. And the rumor itself is interesting because I think it's sort of a pretty good illustration of a problem in biblical interpretation. Because it says here, verse 23, the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. But Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but if it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? We often miss these conditional statements. If I decide that he will remain until I come, what's that to you? He doesn't say that's what's going to happen. Jesus is just making a kind of suppositional statement. And we often read biblical passages that way. We forget the conditions that make another statement true. So basically, you know, he's telling us, be very careful about how you understand what you hear and what you read. I kind of wonder if this isn't maybe a reflection, too, of maybe other people a little bit too concerned about what's going to happen with John. Sort of like Peter is, you know, a little too concerned about John's discipleship. Maybe there's just all this, you know, talking about John and what's going to happen to him. Well, we don't really know. What we have is a statement that Jesus says, if I let him remain, well, okay, what's that to you? Well, what is it to us? Obviously, he didn't. We're 2,000 years past it now, and it didn't happen, and it wasn't ever intended to happen that way. How do I close out? What do we do with all this information? Well, first of all, we note the gospel, it kind of ends very abruptly here. It doesn't really tell us what happens to the apostle. We believe that John's gospel was written a bit later than the other gospels. So it well after the church had been established, perhaps even after several of the other apostles had been already martyred. So there wasn't really any need in terms of the church for John to explain all that. Maybe that's why he just ends it where he does. Everybody knows what the apostles did by then. John has just a different purpose in mind. He ends by simply reflecting on the remarkable life of Jesus Christ. Verse 25. Now there are many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And that's where he ends. We know what happened to the apostles after this. We know about Pentecost. We know about the early church. We know what went on. John just simply saying, look, we're all doing this because of Jesus Christ. And if we had written everything down, we wouldn't have enough room for it here. I gave you enough, and hopefully it's enough to produce faith in you. Hopefully it's enough also for us to kind of be somewhat encouraged by the struggle of the disciples. We're going to have those struggles. We're going to have our moments of doubt. We're going to have our periods when we're not sure if we can go on, but we can. That's the message here, I think, and that's the message I would like for us to take away. I would also like for us to take away the final message, which I think is John's. Can we catch a glimpse of the wonder and the amazement that's implied here in John's statement? The wonder of the life of Christ, the amazement at what he did. It kind of answers a lot of the questions that I've asked here that the apostles were struggling with once you get that. The final thing that really Jesus says to all of us is what he says to Peter. Follow me. Or as we talked about this morning, just keep your eyes on the light. That's what we have to do. Just follow. Whatever happens, you can overcome it. Whatever happens, Jesus is there. Whatever struggles you have, don't allow them to keep you from following Jesus Christ. Eric, shall we stand and sing?